Welcome to Out of the Blank.
Welcome to another episode of Out of the Blank Podcast. I'm here with Gordon. Gordon, for everyone out there listening, please tell everybody a little bit about yourself.
Well, let's see. I'm a retired information technology executive. I spent close to 40 years in the industry with a number of different employers, mostly in public utilities, public hydroelectric utilities specifically. I have a BA in public administration, MBA in information technology management. I got certifications in project management, and I'm a certified professional management consultant. Having said all that, I'm happily retired and enjoying my retirement. But I decided to relate this story, to put it in print, that I'm sure we'll launch into talking about here before too long. And so I have a book that I am trying to make people aware of that I think can provide some valuable work lessons and life lessons for people.
The Intrepid Brotherhood is the book that you are talking about. Now, what exactly, for people out there listening, about the Intrepid Brotherhood? What's it about? What happened? What's the story behind it? Because it's a whistleblower book. It's a book that exposes, I would say, maybe something wrong with a company. I don't know the specifics. At least I forgot the name of the company. I'm just curious to why'd you choose to write a book like this? And if you want to let everybody know a little bit about it as well, too.
The company is the Chelan County Public Utility District, commonly referred to as Chelan County PUD or Chelan PUD. It's in central Washington state. It is actually the third largest non-federal public hydroelectric utility in the nation in terms of generation capacity and revenue. I spent almost 24 years there. The longest term that I spent at any employer during my career. And the book deals with a particular window during that period of time where an individual arrived at our company who really had his own self-interest in mind above anything else. And it caused a tremendous organizational dysfunction, which rippled down or permeated the entire organization. There were a number of us that recognized the potential consequences of his leadership philosophy and tried our best to mitigate it, to appeal to his, what we hoped was better judgment. And that's where the brotherhood concept comes in. Intrepid was just a modifier that I chose to show our perseverance, because we tried a number of different ways to influence the organization positively and change directions back to where it would be more aligned with its original mission and vision, and failed at all of them, unfortunately. That's one thing I have to admit. A number of the brotherhood, quote unquote, members left voluntarily. A couple of us decided that we were going to persevere and try until whatever ultimate resolution emerged to save what we thought was the company we had invested so much time and effort in. And that's where the whistleblower part of the story comes in. That's what we were left with as the only remedy to try to preserve our situations and the investment we had made in ourselves and our careers. And that also failed. They denied the whistleblower petitions that that myself and one of my primary supervisors filed. And I was terminated, not for any particular for cause or performance related reason. It was a matter of convenience. They created a situation where they felt they could get rid of me or eliminate my position, and consequently me along with it, and protect themselves or be protected against any kind of action that I might take against them for doing that. And it turned out differently, and that's what the rest of the story is all about in the book.
Now, when you say story, that people are going to be wondering the question, is this true? Is this not true? It's based on a true story. It's based on what actually happened to you, correct?
It is, absolutely, yeah.
What exactly was the thing that made you, I would say, blow the whistle, or in a sense, just it stopped you in your core? What was the unethical stuff? Can you go into that?
So it's mostly compliance related. Any company has invested a lot of time and money in developing ethics, procedures and policies, and then administrative codes, policies and procedures to follow to make sure they're protected and that they adhere to legal requirements in whatever environment they're operating in. And in our case, the manager actually promoted. That's really kind of a strong word to ascribe to someone in his position, but there's no other way to put it. He promoted the circumvention of requirements, policies and procedures, administrative instructions for things like contract approval, acquiring consulting resources, hiring people, hiring and firing, employee policies as far as treatment in specific situations. So there were some things related to all of those issues under our policies and procedures, as well as a number of things that were specifically related to kind of the centerpiece of the story in the information from the information technology perspective, which was a huge software project, ill-advised, poorly managed, destined to fail. And some of the things that the management structure that was put in place to govern that project, some of the things they did also violated policies, procedures, and compliance issues. And those are the things we blew the whistle on: paying a contractor for work not performed, cost overruns, acquiring consulting resources without opening them up to public bid and evaluation, hiring people without following employment procedures. Most of the things were compliance related.
What was the straw that broke the camel's back for you? Like, what caused you to, because this is a tough spot for anybody who's a whistleblower or for anybody who wants to speak out about things that are going on in their company. Now, I think with a lot of companies, there's rules and ethics that are in place, and there's even HR that goes in it too. The issue starts to become is how powerful is a person in power to where they start doing things that you know aren't right and you know aren't ethical, but nothing is being done about it. And then you're afraid that you're going to lose your job. So you have to come together and get a bunch of people within your organization, the so-called brotherhood, for instance, to really sit and agree with you too. And then you have to be careful to make sure that you are questioning these people to be like, are you in support with me? Or if I tell you this information, are you going to run off to the boss and expose me? I mean, that's a big issue as well too. I mean, there's not enough protection for people that really blow whistles on things. And I hate that word whistleblower in general. It just sounds negative. It's like there should be a more positive thing about wanting to be treated fairly in your job, wanting to have equitable things as well too. And then especially in a company that's hydroelectric power or hydropower, for instance, you want that to be of prime importance when it comes to your ethics and guidelines. I'm just saying, that's not like working at a Verizon Wireless. That's working at a giant corporation that in a sense runs and has a lot of utilities or contracts with other organizations that hold places of power. So bravo on you for even having the courage to stand up, because I think people get into these positions and it's uncomfortable. It's difficult to be in, and they're afraid to voice their opinion in fear that they don't want to lose the money that's going to their pockets because it feeds their families.
So that's very, very perceptive. If you let me get a little bit long-winded, one of the things that my self-publishing company has asked me to do recently is to do some deep dives into some of the leadership themes that are in the book. And one of those is organizational dysfunction. I mentioned a lot in the Intrepid Brotherhood, and I know a number of readers are probably looking at it going, well, what's dysfunction? What's organizational dysfunction? And so I did a piece that they're using as kind of an email lead to try to attract attention to my website and just to promote the book. But what it centers around is how to recognize organizational dysfunction. And one of the big ways is what we just talked about, the compliance discrepancy. If you have someone at the top that is executing or embodying a philosophy of rules for thee, but not for me, that's going to ripple down. And there's going to be a number of people that will immediately subscribe to that philosophy. There will be a number that will have to go through the big dilemma of deciding whether or not they want to try to change the perspective back the way it should be, or to actually subscribe to the CEO or management philosophy. And then there's those of us that fell into the brotherhood category that felt like we needed to actively try to get the attention of enough people to where we could probably create kind of an intervention situation where we as a body went to some of the big stakeholders, like the board, the elected board. After all, who should be more interested in oversight of organizational functions than elected board members? And then perhaps they could get the attention of management and try to make them aware that, well, if we continue doing this, our organization is going to suffer from the top to the bottom, I mean, down to the lowest level. And we're not sure that that's the best strategy for moving forward. It didn't provide us the remedy that we wanted to. We couldn't get the attention of enough people of influence to try to turn things around. But rest assured that we were blowing the whistle on what was going on for an extended period of time, without actually taking advantage of or using the mechanism that was available, filing a petition for whistleblower protection. We were raising the issues and trying to pull the covers back, I suppose, and get things exposed, increase the transparency so that the discussion could be started as to whether or not we were perceiving things correctly and something needed to be done to correct it. The whistleblower petitions that we filed, myself and one of my supervisors, were an absolute last resort. That mechanism, in most cases, is only used to protect your current situation, your job, your career. And when it got to that point, it was obvious to me that they were going to use me as a scapegoat and an excuse that I needed to do something decisive. And so I used the mechanism that was available to try to protect my situation. And they ultimately denied that and every appeal that I made, and for no justifiable reason. Their denials were not accommodated in the policy or the evaluation of my petition. They just chose to do that and were supported all the way up the line. The internal auditor, the general manager, and the commissioners all agreed with the internal legal counsel that my petition did not constitute what was necessary in order to give me protection. And so then they concocted a reason to dismiss me. And that's why in the end, I came back and filed a claim against them, which is kind of the, not really the last chapter, but the last chapter in the book, the story, it, you know, that kind of closing the loop on my interaction with them as a former employer. And, you know, the judgment that I got in my favor that, that made me whole and kind of closed the book on the whole thing.
I, do you happen to have any fears when you were doing that? Like any regrets, like when you're, did you submit something online or was it something you had to file and go in person and push in? Because I can look at two ways of how those can go bad. One, if you submit something online, it'll say request submitted, but how many people are reading that and not just trashing it? Two, if you go into these offices and how these offices are set up to file a claim, usually HR, not really HR, but some type of corporate thing like that, they tend to make it very intimidating to where you're about to put in the file or submit it or do these and you start having regrets. And that is a big thing when it comes to grips. When you write up a piece of paper, you write up anything and there's that, should I send this email? Should I do this? You start counting everything in your head of why you shouldn't do this and why you should. And you start putting a list of pros and cons. And for a lot of people, it's just not worth it because you're opening up the door for them to target you unless you have a group of people behind your back. And not just people in your organization, but people, the general public, the only time you ever seen the public protest or support protesters is in main brand stuff. If you're not talking about a company like Kellogg's, then it's very hard for someone to get behind you if you're supporting this, unless they're other fellow whistleblowers. And that I feel like as people or as the general public should be more interested in people trying to make sure that things are done correctly or be more informed on the actions that companies need to be held responsible for the things that they do. Like you mentioning going to the board of directors, my immediate thought was how much of your words fell on deaf ears? Like there's just people that aren't going to hear that. And so they hear the words production or money. They're not going to start paying attention. So for you, you got to be writing that sales pitch. Like, all right, I got to make sure I incorporate all these words to make it sound like they're going to lose a giant profit.
Okay. So your first question or the first part of your question,
I said a lot,
our process and by ours, I mean, my wife and I, primarily trying to decide whether or not I should pull the trigger on this petition. But we went through some agonizing moments. You can well imagine trying to decide whether or not I actually wanted to do this. And we did talk about, we knew what the potential consequences were. We knew what could come from the increased visibility. And what we decided to do was actually not wait for things to filter through the community and see what happened. We decided to do the spray and pray type thing where I actually included copies of my whistleblower petition to the local newspaper, the local county prosecutor, state auditor's department, the courts, the individual commissioners of the company that I worked for, internal legal counsel, the general manager. My legal counsel, there was just a long list of people that I wanted to copy this petition to with my original filing so that I didn't have to wait to see what the reaction or the comment was going to be when this got passed around or exposed or somebody found out about it. I wanted to know right away, this is it, my reality. This is what I consider to be the situation and the truth. And, you know, I just wanted to find out how they would all respond or how they'd feel about it. I knew, or I felt pretty confident that the community was on our side, so to speak, or was aware of the organizational dysfunction, just because it was all being played out in the newspaper and in public forums, whenever the utility would have a public meeting or a public forum to announce some program or try to respond to a customer complaint or what they can, what they feared was growing dissatisfaction with something they were doing. It was pretty exciting. There were a number of large number of vocal critics in the community, and that attitude was permeating even the election process. There were reform candidates that had emerged for board positions. Everything was just kind of a perfect storm at the time that we filed our petitions, and things were coming to a head as far as this software project. The Wenatchee World, the newspaper, was a constant critic of the manager, and not just because they wanted to be or they felt like they needed to take that position. He earned all of that criticism. And they were, of course, the mouthpiece of the community and the primary, instrument of record of what was going on. And it was obvious that they had no use for, no particular fondness for our general manager and CEO. And then another mechanism, and I want to make sure and mention Dan McConnell, who is the political cartoonist, who submitted cartoons, political sketches to the newspaper for every one of these controversies that came up in the utility. And he was the actual conscience of the customers, of the customer owners of the public utility. Everything that he did was, you know, in that sketch conveyed how the entire valley was feeling about the organization. And that's why after my ghostwriter and I got the manuscript done, I went to Dan and said, "Hey, I remember these sketches. I've got a few of them in hard copy form from newspaper clippings that I saved. What can I do to convince you to let me use these in my book?" And we reached an agreement. He sent me all of the electronic sketch files. And that's why if you pick up the book, everywhere that there is a major issue that I mentioned in there, I inserted the appropriate sketch. And it was just amazing how they followed the timeline perfectly. I want to reiterate, we had the manuscript done when I approached him for his sketches. And when he sent them to me, I just looked at him and went, "Oh, I know where that goes. I know where that goes."
Like a puzzle.
And I just plugged them in. It was perfect. So Dan McConnell, he's a great sketch artist and lives in Kashmir in Central Washington. And I want to make sure and call him out because although I credit him in the book, I need to make sure and mention him and his work and how important it was to me to be able to include those sketches.
Can you give me an example of one of these controversies that people knew about or one of these things that knew about, or can you go into the specifics of like, maybe like, you don't have to say exactly what this software does, but maybe an example of what it would be like, well, if you did this, then power would be taken from these homes or data, whatever it would be. Could you just give me an example or go into a little bit of the specifics?
So the software, Dan didn't do any sketches specifically related to the software project. It was mostly the concept of overspending or ill-advised spending, those types of things. The software was and is, because they still use it, PeopleSoft, and the utility bought. And it's probably going to take readers who are familiar with information technology to really appreciate this, but they bought 42 modules and a large enterprise resource planning software system like PeopleSoft or JD Edwards or Oracle. That means a system that is capable of running or serving the entire Defense Department. Well, here we are, a public utility in Central Washington that, the first thing I said when we started talking was it is the third largest public non-federal hydroelectric utility in the nation. But still, we have, or they have, I think less than 20,000 residential customers, right? Maybe 20 to 30,000. Yeah, and then they hired an implementation partner who, to their credit, had experience implementing this particular piece of software or this software system, but even that hire would not have been required if they had scaled the system or the requirements to the size of our organization and gotten a software product that was that fit much better and cost a whole lot less. And we may have even been able to implement it ourselves with just some help from the manufacturer, because actually it was done at the utility that I went to work for right afterwards. After I was terminated, we got a system that I had already looked at my previous employer, and it fit most, if not all, of the requirements that they had put out for bid when they acquired PeopleSoft, and would have been much cheaper and much more easily implemented. Probably the worst part of the project was just the fact that we believe that the CEO had the ulterior motive of eventually outsourcing the entire IT function, which is not unheard of. I mean, it's fine as long as you've evaluated the whole outsourcing model and equation and determined whether or not it is in your best interest to supplant your entire IT organization rather than supplement it with resources to achieve the efficiencies that you want. Once again, that's not in the layman's terms that it should be, but it was a knee-jerk decision on his part. And we felt like this project was just the first step in him trying to do that, because he made us, my entire department, subservient to number one, an additional layer of management infrastructure that he created out of folks that had no information technology experience, no project management experience, no change management experience, no requirements definition experience. It was a fool's mission, and it was destined to fail. Our protests against that, fell on deaf ears, and so we had to just consider that that's what we were going to be operating under going forward. And so we disciplined ourselves. My mantra was, okay, so we've got these folks that are going to be spinning around in the drum trying to figure out what to do, and we need to discipline ourselves to help them as much as possible, because if they're not successful, they're going to point fingers at us and we'll be the scapegoats. I think that was the design originally, that if anything went south on this project, they would blame us, even though we had no control. Everything was out of our control. We were made subservient to them as well as the contract and implementation partner. So my staff, being paid out of my budget, was also made subservient to a contractor that was being paid from a separate project contract. So it was just, it was a situation that defied logic. and yet we tried our best to bail them out of every situation and to help them succeed. When it came to the point where it was obvious that they weren't going to meet deadlines, that cost overruns were getting exorbitant, and even the board members and steering committee members were starting to ask questions, they couldn't manipulate them any longer to the degree that they needed to, they started pointing fingers at me and my staff. Things like we were sabotaging the project, we were insubordinate, none of which was true, that we were intentionally trying to make this project fail. And in the absence of any compelling evidence to the contrary, since they had the ear of executive management, the steering committee, and the elected board members, that perception became reality. And so we were all tarred and feathered and cast in an unfavorable light.
When it comes to it sounds like a front in a sense. It sounds like, was there anything bigger than just eliminating the IT department, or was that going to leak down into all systems? Because I can't stop thinking about the 42 modules that they bought. Like, if that's enough to say, like, run like a defense system or something like that, it's bigger than that. I wonder what they were branching out into, because it seemed like if you're going to replace workers without them knowing, just cutting them out last minute, which is probably what was happening, and you guys spoke out about it just to save your own jobs. But what are the implications to what they were going towards? Were they trying to expand out and enter a different avatar? Like, we see Disney used to be an amusement park and make movies. Now they own, it seems like, everything. So I'm just like, is this where we were going? They were looking to expand out into other territories in their original utility purposes.
So one motivation, at least we believe, one motivation for the manager pursuing or promoting this project was so that he would have the large systems feather in his bonnet when he went out to look for, you know, a position somewhere like Duke Energy or somewhere in a private company. He would be able to say, well, yeah, we implemented PeopleSoft at Chelan PUD, and I did this, that, and the other thing. So there was just simply that large systems feather to put on his resume. But I think the outsourcing was tied to what we believe was his objective of getting one of his former, he came from the private consulting environment. He came from Deloitte & Touche, and he had many contacts in the consulting industry, and he paraded them through our organization regularly. I got to meet most of them, which was fine. But it became apparent after a while that what he wanted to do was send work their way without open competition, the requirements that a public agency has to issue an RFP.
Dude, you stopped down a freaking monopoly, bro. You were in that's the process of how monopolies get started, man. You're one of those stories and voices that stops these things from happening, because that only leads to bigger and deeper connections, man. Nobody just gives up power. That doesn't happen in any part of the world.
So just to close the loop, and you're already there, but
I'm losing my mind. I'm over here with banners saying, yeah, Gordon.
We believe what he wanted to do was take that 42 module software system that was purchased by the public owners of the utility district and provide that power, that capability to one of his private cohorts in the consulting industry, one of their companies, to sell subscriptions to anybody, to other utilities, to anybody that couldn't afford to implement that software themselves. So he wanted to take that system that was created or purchased by the public in Wenatchee Valley and make it available to a private company to function as a service bureau to sell subscriptions to different entities, which is actually something that I was pursuing late in my career there, but through a public model. I was working with Washington Public Power Supply System, and some of my peers in the industry, in the public utility industry, to create a joint operating agency so that those of us that had or were implementing these larger software systems could provide that capability to smaller utilities, through some kind of monetary exchange. They'd have to pay, so it would be a subscription type of thing. But that way, Chelan PUD could recover their cost to a certain degree, or at least pay for continuing operating expenses. And then these smaller utilities would have the capability of this larger software system to the degree that they needed to use it and could afford it. That failed mainly because it was sabotaged by my manager and some of the people that I reported to in the organization. And I think largely because he had this private model in mind. He was trying to actually take this public investment and provide it to, or create a private model so that people could make money off of it outside of the public domain. More evidence of that is in the book. There is a particular incident called the Port Ludlow meeting, and that simply refers to a resort community where many of the executives and board members from our organization met with various different utility experts and people from the legal entities to try to determine how they could create a private spinoff from our public utility to be able to sell wholesale power, like many of the power marketers, private power marketers do in places like Houston. But they wanted to do that at our organization so that individuals could make money. They would create a private entity that would be in charge of selling wholesale power, and they would have an elected board who would probably be the same people that sat on our public utility board, only they would get paid a commission or part of the commissions from selling public power. So it immediately was attractive to our elected board members for the public utility because, hey, we can make some money this way. But it raised the hackles of the community once it was made public, because they have all these public resources, or resources that were created for the public interest to do things like the original mission and strategy of the company to keep costs down, be a low-cost power provider, and be responsive to services and needs of the public owners of the utility. And here they were trying to create something that was completely private and perhaps not in the best interest of the people that actually paid for and owned, the public ratepayers that own the utility. So a lot of stuff going on that.
It's a spider web, man. You got a bunch of stuff going on there. I look at it like this, though. If they would have had a more effective strategy, because I don't think they took into account the amount of the brotherhood or the workers that were going to rise up and kind of speak out about these issues. I mean, they could easily have sales pitched it like, hey, we're going to put this into private hands where you pay a subscription. It's going to be cheaper, but then they can just control it as much as they want. And they get to choose whether or not the price goes up and down. It becomes like gas. Gas is like a monopoly. I mean, you see one gas station raise its price, the other one raises its price. Like, they all flow off of each other. It's much like cable companies too. You just stopped it from, I guess, manifesting, which, I mean, it leads into a bigger thing, which is like, when did they start, you know, when they raise up subscriptions, when did they start investing in other things like doing this that's going to be a public works but turned out to be a private thing where you have to pay a lot of money? Next thing you know, you see a 5-star hotel go up. It starts to get suspicious when you're tracking receipts.
And that may be the biggest issue, although I don't think they could have done it differently, but it all boils down to transparency and communication. And if, like you say, if they would have engaged all the stakeholders in trying to determine whether or not they should do what they wanted to do or what the manager wanted to do, then it would have been more acceptable. The process would have been something that people felt a whole lot better about. But I don't think he could do that because it would have been obvious that what he was doing was contrary to the mission and vision and original strategy of the public utility as a state chartered public agency. And so there wasn't any way that it could be inclusive. He couldn't accomplish what he wanted to by engaging everyone, which is unfortunate. It should be that way. You should have communication and respect and all those processes. I mean, that's a huge change management issue, right? And that's the way you need to approach things like that. Only he couldn't do it just because of the nature of what he wanted to do. And so it was destined, I think, to create this confrontation that it did.
Now, when you went to, you took this to court, right? Like this became a, how long did the court process go?
So it took quite a while for my legal counsel and myself to actually pull the trigger on the claim and request a court proceeding. We filed the claim within the original period that was required to get it on record after I was terminated. But during the whole interim, he was trying to negotiate a settlement, or the primary objective was to get me reinstated back to the valley where my family was. At that time, both of my parents were still alive, and they had moved to the community that I lived in to live out their final years, specifically because I was there. And I was forced to leave when I got terminated. My wife and I had to leave, and so they were left up there. My kids stepped up and did what they could to fill in the gap, but it's still, I was displaced and had to relocate, and it had an impact. So my attorney was really trying to get me reinstated and get back to the valley. But he could not make that impression on the utility. They dug their heels in and they would not settle. They wouldn't, I think for fear that they would have felt like it would have admitted wrongdoing and kind of opened the floodgates for other people who the manager had damaged and who wanted to try to make themselves whole. So they didn't budge. And in the end, he asked me, well, so do you want to ultimately seek justice by going to trial, or do you want to just let this go? And my wife and I looked at each other and went, you know, we've gone this far, and what has happened in the interim hasn't changed the reality. They did what they did. And we really wanted the public to know the rest of the story. A lot of that got suppressed in pretrial motions and what was allowable as far as testimony. And so that's why I ended up writing the book, because otherwise people wouldn't have known everything that was going on behind the scenes and what the ultimate motivation was for all of this and why it happened. But yeah, that was why we decided to move forward with the trial. It took, 5 years after I was terminated before, almost 5 years before we went to trial.
Wait, so you were gone from your original home for 5 years?
Yeah, well, we're still gone from there.
Why did you have to leave?
Well, there wasn't anywhere else in the valley where I could work and maintain or achieve the same kind of position and compensation that I had at Chelan PUD. There were a couple of positions that were occupied by people that I considered to be peers, but they weren't ready to retire or leave, and they were happily employed. So I immediately started a job search, and we moved. I relocated originally. My wife stayed up there for, I think, the first year and a half that I was employed elsewhere, and I commuted back and forth. And then she decided, you know, we both looked at each other and went, well, I'm not going to get back to the valley. It's been a year and a half, so let's sell our place and move. So we came down to this little community in Oregon.
Did you look at your old boss, and when you, like, in the court proceeding, you should have shook his hand and you should have been like, I'm going to use you as a reference. You should have. Yeah. That would have been hilarious.
There's a lot of good stuff in the book about those trial proceedings, but the real, the real drama doesn't come through. I don't think you can adequately convey those things in words. The CEO, I was gone in, I think, July of 2004, and he left the utility in October of 2006. No, 2005. So he was there for less, what, around 14, 15 months after I was terminated. And I think the biggest reason is, I think everybody agrees, that he just saw the writing on the wall. The two reform candidates that were running for board positions were elected overwhelmingly. The community was getting more and more vocal about the actions that he had taken, and actually a lot of it was related to my dismissal and their dissatisfaction. There were other departments, other members of the Brotherhood, people I'm still in touch with, who have great stories about how they stood up to him and caused him a great deal of consternation late in his career. And so he just saw his control was evaporating, and he was not the kind of person who wanted to stay if he wasn't entirely in control. He had lost at least half of his influence on the elected board, and the community was up in arms. The newspaper was up in arms. He was being questioned about a lot of the things that he had done. And so I think it's safe to say that not too long after that election, when he knew those board members were coming on, that he started looking for the right job. And so he was gone in October of 2005. And the depositions for my trial didn't start until September of 2008. And the trial actually didn't begin until, I think, February of 2009. So he'd been gone for a while.
Did he smell like sulfur? But,
pardon me?
Did he smell like sulfur?
always. There were a number of people who were still there who were subscribers to his philosophy, or at least rolled over and did what he asked them to do. A couple of them in particular we call out in the narrative about the trial, and it was pretty sweet what happened there, what they had to reveal, and how they got caught in their own lies. And
Do you ever regret? Do you think that maybe what happens if you just would have, like, maybe kept a little silent and maybe took some money here and there, that you might be a little bit like all those years lost, for instance, when it comes to, you just could have been living in the same place? Or do you prefer what happened? Do you prefer that you took this route and you got to write a book about it and you get to talk about it and really help out? Because, I mean, you stood by what a lot of people wouldn't do in that scenario, and you stood by your moral obligation to just help the public out, which is a very rare thing nowadays. I mean, it takes even if you ask me to weigh up my decisions of, you know, my family, my home, my life, my career against, you know, just because you feel like this would help the people out, or you got to be pro people, it's hard, because you get flicked off in traffic one day and you're like, I hate people. And then you got to stand with this decision where it's going to impact a lot of people's lives. And that's something that gets set in stone.
So I've had that question a lot, and we actually address it in the book. I would prefer that things had resolved much differently. I think that's just something everybody can assume. I would not have made a different decision under those circumstances, looking back. I did not. There wasn't any way that I could just check out, like, mentally, and put in my time during the day and just subscribe to what was going on. And that's another one of the deep dives that my publishing company asked me to do, that dilemma. And I think you can just refer to it that way, because in a situation like that, where you have a policy coming from the top that demands loyalty, that is coming from a soul-sucking CEO that promotes workplace harassment and I guess circumvention of compliance requirements, you have to make a decision. You have to decide if you're going to subscribe to that, or if you are going to do what you can to correct the situation, not necessarily confront it, because, well, I guess you are in a certain way, but it implies conflict when you do that. And what you're trying to do is avoid conflict. You're just trying to raise the awareness and get the discussion going so that intelligent people can see what needs to be done to correct the situation. And that's what we were trying to do. But there's a number of people that we call out or mention in the story in the book that made the other decision, that faced that dilemma and went down the other fork in the road. And, you know, maybe all you can say is something like Jackson Brown in his lyrics, say a prayer for the pretender, because that's what they're doing. I don't really believe that those folks subscribe to that morality. I think that they just did it because, well, one example, and the one that I just did in the piece I did for my publishing company, this one individual that worked for me, the observation that I made is that we sat and watched him one day looking out the window at a local watering hole after we'd been playing golf. And he was talking to himself and he was saying things like, I've got kids in college, I got a house to pay for. And we were sitting right there across the table from him. And he wasn't looking at us, he was looking out the window. And he was devouring himself from the inside, trying to resolve the decision that he was making. And we knew at that point that he had, to use contemporary terms, I guess, turned to the dark side, and he was subscribing to the philosophy of the manager. And so to a certain degree, we had to be careful about how we acted and talked around him. And I still treated him like a valuable employee, but I can attribute some things to him late in the story that are unfortunate. And they were obviously a result of him making that decision. So it's the dilemma, the big dilemma, and everybody has to make that decision in that situation, regardless of your capacity in the organization, because you're going to feel it, you're going to look at it, and you're going to go, can I deal with that? Can I live with that? Or can't I?
Yeah. I have one last question for you, and that's with, after writing the book and going through what your experience, did you ever think to reach out or maybe do more of a deep dive on other whistleblowers or other potential spots where people are in a tough scenario like that, and try and maybe think about, like, I'm not saying a part two just because you still got this one, but I mean, in a sense, a combination of experience and highlighting, I mean, going through that scenario, from anybody that knows being in a hard position in life and work, especially when it shouldn't be like that. It should be, you're going to work, you're making money. It shouldn't be something where you're experiencing anxiety or stress, or you're feeling like you're just not worthy. It's a tough scenario for a lot of people. There's a lot of experiences out there. I bet you could make a whole nother book on just, your relation, your interview process, you experiencing what they experienced.
No, I haven't. I have reached out to a couple of people who have written books, who are actual whistleblowers, trying to get to be able to share information, I guess, and be able to promote each other's works. So it's kind of a selfish or materialistic type of approach, but I haven't actually considered interviewing anybody else or collaborating with anybody else on trying to put a work like that together. Naturally, I've done research with organizations that represent whistleblowers. Some of my favorite quotes, I think, came from the Government Accountability Project. I think their legal director is a fellow by the name of Thomas Devine. And he said, whistleblowing is the sound of professional suicide. I saw that and I thought, man, I feel that. And then there's some others that have written books on the subject and do periodicals, podcasts, and that type of thing that I follow. but I haven't really reached out to anybody to try to collaborate on anything. Perhaps if more people become familiar with my book, those invitations will come and something will become obvious and we'll accomplish something in that regard. But I haven't reached out to anybody to do that.
Well, I appreciate you giving me your time to talk on the podcast and let everybody know where they can find the Intrepid Brotherhood. If you have any links, you know where people can find you. If you want to say them off just for people listening, and I'll make sure I link it in the description as well.
So the best thing, the best resource probably is my website, intrepidbrotherhood.com. It's got background of the story, testimonials, links to where you can buy it, quotes, you can sign up for the email list, that type of thing. I have a LinkedIn profile, which is just my name, pretty easy to find. It's got the picture of the book on it, so you can tell me from anybody else that might have the same name. My Facebook author page is In Search of Aristotle, which is kind of a mouthful. And all I do out there really is share relevant whistleblower and ethics content that I come across, usually in my LinkedIn profile. There's a lot of good stuff that comes in there, and I will share it both on LinkedIn and then also on my Facebook author page. Those are the primary resources. And you can submit a web contact form if you want to ask me any questions or provide feedback on my website. Go out, take advantage of the opportunity to learn more about the book and hopefully pull the trigger on it and buy it.
Well, I'll link it all in the description. It's been a pleasure chatting with you, Gordon. Thanks for listening to this episode of Out of the Blank Podcast.